Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Monday, August 15th, 2016. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, we'll talk about health matters with diabetes educator Cynthia Nickerson. Jim Penner will be here to highlight CBJ Recycle Works. We'll find out more about the first folio readings with Donnie Gott and Eric Kufner. And we'll talk with filmmaker Catherine Axley about her film In Progress about legendary dog musher George Atla. Those interviews, National Native News Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more right here on a Juno afternoon. Currently 57 degrees in Gustavus, 59 in Hoonah, and 58 here in the capital city.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The leader of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe is discussing the tribe's opposition to the Dakota Access Pipeline project as protesters continue to gather near a construction site in North Dakota. Chairman Dave Archambault is holding a press conference today. He was among those arrested at the protests last week. More than a dozen people have been arrested, mostly for disorderly conduct. The tribe and protesters are concerned the pipeline, which would transport oil between North Dakota and Illinois, threatens water and cultural and historical resources. The proposed project would cross waterways and is less than 1/2 mile from the tribe's homeland. The tribe says it has repeatedly voiced opposition to the federal government, the developer of the project, and members of Congress. Some South Dakota tribes are publicly expressing their support, including the Rosebud Sioux Tribe and the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe. Leaders of the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe passed a resolution of support last week. Both Native and non-Native people from across the country are taking part in the protest. According to the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, numbers at the protest camp last week were around a couple hundred and are expected to grow as supporters travel to the camp. A lawsuit by the tribe is scheduled to be heard in federal court next week. The Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa is among 8 counties in northern Wisconsin that has received a federal disaster declaration. As Marcus White reports, the tribe is trying to repair homes after flooding damaged the reservation last month.
The band is working with the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the State Department of Transportation to continue to fix damage to roads, especially in heavily impacted rural areas. 46 homes were affected by the flooding. At least 9 have been destroyed. Bad River Flood Command Center spokesman Dylan Jennings says that the damage is much more than just about the homes.
People not only lost their childhood homes, but they also lost material things that we kind of take for granted every day. Everything from picture albums to ceremonial things to our everyday commodities that we have.
Jennings says the displaced families are being housed either with relatives or at the Bad River Tribe's nearby lodge and casino. Long-term housing is still in the works. This year's crop of wild rice is still uncertain, but Jennings says the annual powwow dedicated to the harvesting of the rice will go on.
We still have to acknowledge, you know, that spirit for everything that it has done for us over the years and over the many generations that our people have been in this area. You know, big thing is to also give thanks to everybody and everything that has been watching over our community and acknowledging all the help and assistance that we've received over this trying time.
Flood damage to the Bad River Tribe and northern Wisconsin is estimated at $35 million. I'm Marcus White.
The Arizona Court of Appeals ruled against an Arizona tribe in an adoption case last week. The Associated Press reports the court ruled the Gila River Indian community acted too late in trying to intervene in the adoption of a girl to a non-Native couple. The tribe sought to have jurisdiction under the Indian Child Welfare Act. The mother of the child is reportedly a citizen of Gila River. The tribe is said to be reviewing its options. The U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs is holding a field hearing this week in North Dakota. The hearing addressing trauma and mental health challenges in Indian country will take place in Bismarck at the United Tribes Technical College on Wednesday. Leaders in tribal health care and federal officials are among those scheduled to testify. The hearing is to examine the impacts adverse childhood experiences have on Native youth and tribal communities. North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp says she's working to raise awareness on the issue and seek solutions. A panel in Minnesota recommends moving 2 paintings, which critics say portrays Native Americans inaccurately, from the governor's reception room in the state capitol to other locations. The Minnesota State Capitol Preservation Commission released a report today, citing the move should be made after meetings with tribal leaders and public input. The Capitol is under restoration. There are currently no suggestions for new locations or replacements for the paintings. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Since 1970, NARF has stood firm for justice in Indian country on critical issues like treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior. Stand firm with NARF. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to A June Afternoon here on Monday, August 15th, 2016. Scott Burton, your host, and in the studio with me now is Cynthia Nickerson. She's a registered nurse and a certified diabetes educator at Bartlett Hospital, and she's going to tell us about health matters coming up here at the end of the month. Welcome to the show, Cynthia.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here. Tell us a little bit about what it means to be a certified diabetes educator and registered nurse at Bartlett.
Well, a certified diabetes educator is someone who has had at least 1,000 hours of training in diabetes, and in order to be a CDE, as we call it, you have to be a doctor, a nurse, a registered dietitian, a pharmacist, a podiatrist, or have a master's degree.
Okay, and there's a lot of fields you can go into in medicine. May I ask what inspired you to become a CDE, as you say?
I was working in Kodiak, Alaska at the Kodiak Area Native Association, and they had a job opening for someone to manage their diabetes grant, and I was just a part-time temporary nurse. They asked me to take the position, and here I am 17 years later.
Okay.
Specializing in diabetes.
So this program, Health Matters, is a one-year program, is that right?
It is. It's a very big commitment. It's the Health Matters program is actually a diabetes prevention program that was developed by the Centers for Disease Control, and it's aimed at preventing persons from getting type 2 diabetes. So before people get diabetes, most everyone has a condition called prediabetes, which, if nothing is done about it, will, in most cases, go on to develop type 2 diabetes. What we found out, though, is that if we work with these people who have prediabetes by doing simple things like, well, I shouldn't say weight loss, but because that's not all that simple, but by losing some weight, learning how to cook healthy foods, and increasing exercise, they can change that prediabetes condition and go back to having normal blood sugars.
Remind us the difference or the similarities between type 1 and type 2 diabetes.
With type 1 diabetes, we usually think of little kids who develop it very young in age. And the mechanism that happens is, for some reason, the pancreas is a little organ that sits behind our stomach. For some reason, it just quits producing insulin. We really don't know why. With type 2 diabetes, which is the most prevalent kind of diabetes, there are a couple things that are going on in the body. The body has just quit listening to the insulin that we normally produce, or over time, we're just not making quite as much, but we still make some insulin.
Okay. So this class begins, or this program begins, on August 29th, is that right?
Yes.
And what's the frequency that you'll meet with these individuals? What's the class look like, the whole program?
Well, the class is taught by lifestyle coaches who've been trained in prediabetes, and they've learned this program, again, developed by the Centers for Disease Control. It's a group class. We start meeting every Monday night from 5:30 to 6:30 for 16 weeks. After 16 weeks, we'll then meet once a month until for another 6 months. And that way, you know, we work with people to help them get their exercise increased, learning how to eat healthy. Again, weight loss is a goal. Only about 5 to 7% of a weight loss. So it's not a huge weight loss. But that 5 to 7% can mean the difference between developing type 2 diabetes or preventing it.
Is there sort of a target demographic or age group or person that's listening right now that should really be thinking about this class?
Well, it's open to persons age 18 or older, but we're really targeting people who have prediabetes But our grant is actually written for people who are 60 or over and their caregivers. So they actually have priority in the class. But if there's room, and we think we'll have two classes, it's open to anybody in the Juneau area over the age of 18.
Is prediabetes something that somebody can be diagnosed with officially, or is it just, how's that work?
It is. So the only way to diagnose prediabetes is through a blood draw at your physician's office. Interesting thing, for years now, our government has said that type 2 diabetes is an epidemic, and we have about 24 million people who have diabetes, but we have 80 million people with prediabetes. So we have a much higher population of those with prediabetes. It's a sneaky condition, though, in that most people, well, actually everyone who has prediabetes doesn't have signs or symptoms of prediabetes. The only way to know if you have it is to have that blood test at your doctor's office.
Okay. Tell us what one of these sessions might look like. You touched on it a little bit, working with some of these dietitians and some of your colleagues. What would an average session look like?
Well, an average session, again, it's led by two of our lifestyle coaches, and they are persons who are trained in prediabetes and in this program. They have a curriculum that was written by the Centers for Disease Control, and they tackle a topic every week. Again, it's an hour program, and one week it might be just ways to fit in more vegetables into your life. Another week it might be ways to increase your activity. One of the neat things about this program is we actually offer group get-togethers to go to the pool maybe to exercise, or we might go to the Diamond Field House and go walking together. So we offer ways for people to get together as a group and just, make it a fun event, exercise with other people.
Yeah, a mental, fun social event as well, right?
For absolutely.
Physical and mental health.
Yes. Yeah.
Great, and it's free.
It is free. We got a grant from the state about 2 years ago that allows us not to charge, which is fabulous, and we're really glad that we can offer that. The only thing, though, about this program is it really is a big time commitment. And if someone's looking for just quick weight loss, this is not the program for them. But if someone is really, truly committed to improving their health, this is a great program. You'll get support. You'll get information about, better ways of living, healthier ways of living. And one of the nicest parts is people completing this program will decrease or at least delay developing type 2 diabetes by about 58%. So that's a significant number in medicine.
Somebody wants to sign up. How can they do that?
The best way to sign up is to contact me at the hospital. My number is 796-8649, and I can get an application out to them and talk to them a little more about the program.
Okay. Again, that number is 796-8649.
Yes.
Cynthia Nickerson. If just for the rest of us that maybe aren't going to go to this class, what are some things in general that we can do to help prevent prediabetes?
Well, I think physical activity is a big, big thing. Movement is big. I love the phrase move it or lose it. It really is true. We really need to be using our muscles, and that's one way to keep our bodies really in good shape and finely tuned.
And like going to the gym, big workouts, or just walking?
Walking. You don't have to go to the gym to get a workout. You can just go for a walk, even just shopping, around some of the large stores that we have in town. That's a great way just to get in some extra steps and get that movement.
Okay. Cynthia Nickerson, she's a registered nurse and certified diabetes educator, and the class, Health Matters, the one-year program to prevent diabetes, starts on August 29th, and this is at the hospital, is that right?
Yes, it is.
And it's Monday nights from 5:30 to 6:30?
Yes.
Okay. And for more information, 796-8649. Cynthia, is there anything else you'd like to talk about?
I do want to mention that it's not just for people who have prediabetes. If you are at a higher risk for developing diabetes, you are eligible for this class also.
And how do people know if they're at a higher risk? Just genetically?
If they have a family member, like a first family member, like a parent or a brother or sister who have diabetes, then they've got a higher risk.
Okay. For more information, again, 796-8649. Cynthia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
the first time. Ever I saw your face, I thought the sun rose in your eyes. And the moon and the stars were the gifts you gave. To the dark and the endless sky, my love. And the first time, ever I kissed your mouth, I felt the earth move through my hands. Like the trembling heart of a captive bird, that was there at my command. And the first time, ever I lay with you, I felt your heart so close to mine. And I know our joy would fill the earth and last till the end of time, my love. The first time ever I saw your face.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, August 15, 2016. Scott Burton, your host, and Jim Penner is in the office, the studio here with us. Solid waste coordinator, maybe that's going to change. We don't know. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Okay, so I was just trying to wrap my head around everything you're telling me. CBJ Recycle Works, tell our listeners about it.
CBJ Recycle Works is our new brand name, and we have come up with a logo. There was a lot of confusion per CBJ Waste Management. Waste Management owns the landfill, Capital Landfill. Arrow has the refuse. People call it Waste Management, City Waste Management Division. Wasn't the right real logo or lettering for you know what CBJ does. Descriptive wise, our job basically with CBJ is to recycle and divert waste from the landfill.
Got it. So just to look at this again, Waste Management
yep.
owns the landfill.
That's correct.
Okay. Arrow Refuse goes out with their trucks and such and collects the trash and takes it to the landfill.
That's correct.
And you guys do your best to recycle and divert materials from there.
That's correct.
All right. And so your new division, which was solid waste.
Solid waste coordinator,
right?
Which is really confusing somewhat for the citizens. You know, landfill this, we're going to make it more identifiable for the citizens as we are Recycle Works.
All right.
And, I mean, we're changing up everything. You know, we've got the branding name. We have got a logo we just picked out. And early as last Tuesday, Wednesday, we were going through quite a few color combinations for our logo and finally come up and picked our color combination for our logo here last Tuesday or Wednesday. And now they're being made.
Okay, so that's CBJ Recycle Works. You're telling me you have some new bins in town.
Yes, I've been excited. I've been working on this for about a year and a half or longer. What they are is they're a drop box style that you'll see like roll-off construction containers, but they're specifically made to deposit recycling commodities into. Three of them that we bought, it's a pilot program, three of them we bought have two false walls in the middle inside that makes a three bin. So you could have aluminum on one end, plastics in the middle, and I actually have, we're going to try it out to even do glass.
So these are pretty big.
They're a 30 foot, you know, or 20, excuse me, 20, 21 feet long, 8 feet wide, and they hold 30 yards.
Okay.
Cubic yards.
Where are they going to be located?
Right now, our locations are JRC, the club out on Riverside.
Okay.
It's going to have two containers located there. One of the containers is going to be the three bin for aluminum, mixed plastics, and then glass. And we're going to put a one wall, two bin out there for cardboard and mixed paper. It'll be a one-stop shop. So citizens driving around in their normal daily activities, going to the clubs, trying to make it more convenient to recycle and actually hopefully pull in some people that weren't, you know, citizens that weren't previously recycling and make it more easier for them. I've heard numerous times it's difficult to recycle. You put it in your car. You can only recycle certain days. You know, you drive around for a couple of days. You get diverted. So my goal is to put these in locations where citizens travel and make it more convenient.
Right, because right now, if you go to the dump, you can recycle on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
Exactly.
Right? Some people have curbside pickup, right?
That's correct. That's an Arrow Refuse program.
Okay.
That's correct.
And then now, though, this sounds like 24/7, you could go to any of these bins.
That's correct. The two will be at the JRC Club. There's going to be one at Aurora Harbor for the harbor patrons and citizens, and there's going to be one at Staten Harbor.
Okay. Well, that sounds great. Cool.
You must have one extra one that I'm gonna kind of put in different locations and try out.
I can hear the downtown and Douglas listeners right now going Douglas.
Yeah,
downtown.
Well, and that would be nice. We number one, we need, it's a pilot program. I have five containers. We want to get it started out there and roll it out in a slow rollout mode. Make sure that we got everything working correctly. Citizens, you know, are tuned in and putting in the right material in the right bins. It's going to be a little bit of a hiccup in a educational process, but I'm excited about it. I'm looking forward to working through them issues and getting these containers out, making it more convenient, and hopefully, in number one goal, increase the recycling within CBJ and divert waste from the landfill.
If we have a listener out there right now who's skeptical about recycling, what would your advice to them be? Why is it important for us to recycle?
For CBJ, it's important to divert waste from that landfill. Basically, we'll try to make it last as long as we can. That landfill is a permitted landfill under the state of Alaska. It currently has, you know, a life expectancy, and the more we can pull out of recyclable commodities. I'm actually on my source separated material. I'm not like the curbside, put it all in one bin. My CBJ's program, which has always been a program way before my time, was a source separated program, and right now, the commodities are kind of leveling out a little bit, and we're starting to get see some actual little bit of revenue off them, but don't think that we're making money. And what it does is, what my goal is to offset the cost of the program. My program costs so much annually. If I can get the commodities and get prices on the other end, then that keeps everybody's taxes low.
Sure. Once the product gets to the dump, do you guys keep your stuff separate from what Aero Refuse collects?
Most definitely.
Most definitely. So they're sending the mixed stuff down and you're sending yours separate? How's that work?
That's kind of, you know, if citizens remember here a few years back, you were able to recycle 5 days a week. And Aero started the curbside, see how that goes. They have that curbside currently operating. And that's a co-mingled where everything goes in one bin. So we had to, the landfill per contract with Aero had to open up some days to allow them trucks that pick it up curbside to come in. That stuff is kept totally separate from our stuff, the CBJ generated recycling commodities. And we have the source separated, and I'm going to keep it that way, hopefully as long as I can.
All right. Is there anything we can do better as members of the general public?
So far so good on the recycling drop-off at the Capital Landfill there. Our commodities are fairly clean. Yes, citizens in that can always help out by making sure that, number one, it's getting more difficult and difficult to figure out your plastics. But if you look at the bottom or on the side, you will see the national and international recycling three arrows logo and a number in there. And currently, right now, CBJ, we recycle number one and number two plastic. So if you see a one or two, we can recycle it. Unfortunately, the curbside program has a one through seven plastics, and I can't find a market for the three through seven plastics. Matter of fact, as far as I know, there isn't a market for it. So that's my problem. If I could find a market, a sustainable market, then we would start doing that commodities. I'm always got an open mind and looking at what's going on within the industry to stay abreast of the recycled products and markets and what's out there.
And let's see, just to double check, of course, aluminum as well, tin, right?
Yeah.
These are things that you guys collect.
That's correct.
And what's happening with the glass these days? I've always heard different stories about that.
It's really never changed. The glass commodity price is either 0 to 0.5 cents a pound. About 8 years ago, it was 2 cents a pound. Well, glass is fairly condensed and heavy. So you look at our shipping costs, and it just doesn't financially work out. So what we do is we take that glass and we store it separately, and it gets crushed up at the landfill and it gets saved as an aggregate. During the winter months, them trucks, you know, a landfill's a moving puzzle. You take in 300 ton a day and you're kind of got a half a house, and next day, you know, you got a big, you know, it's a moving target. And the trucks are always moving in and out of there, and you have to keep them moving in and out. Well, in the wintertime, you could put aggregate rock in there, and the rock lasts a little bit, and then it just disappears in the mud. Well, glass binds up like toothpicks. And we have found out that it's it'll keep the road bases going in for the vehicles and commercial trucks in and out of the landfill. So it's a beneficial use.
Okay. Jim, what else is new with you guys?
Oh, we got a lot of, you know, we have a new website that will be up and running here within the next 2 to 3 weeks. I'm not 100% abreast on the website. This is all a team effort. This isn't a CBJ Jim Panora operation. This basically is a team effort. Michelle Elfers, in engineering, she's been the kind of overseer and spearhead in a lot of these new programs. She's opened up composting. She's putting some compost kits in schools. So you parents out there might hear your kids come home and got all educated on how to compost, and that's our plan. So Michelle's been working on that in the website, but it's a team effort.
Okay. Anything else you want to add?
Hazardous Waste, always open Fridays and Saturdays, 8 to 4:30. There is no, there is a limit of how many pounds you can bring in per day or per drop-off, let's say, 100 pounds. The reason being we're trying to keep the traffic flowing through there freely, which I think the citizens can attest now they're not sitting in lines of traffic there. We are taking all e-waste now, where before it was only one TV or one computer screen, monitor screen. We're taking it. If it has a plug-in and it runs, as long as it's not a refrigerated appliance, I'll take it. Vacuum cleaner, cell phones, you name it, CD players, we take it. And actually, I've worked the contractor down south and actually are getting 10 cents a pound on the hard drives.
Oh, wow. And remind us what else you can take the hazardous waste.
Fry oil. Vegetable fry oil. On our new website, we're going to have it very user-friendly, way better than what was there before. I apologize to everybody out there that's pulled up that internet site and tried to weed through it, but we're going to try to make it a one- or two-click operation to get you where you want to go. That's our goal. So you're going to see blocks, hazardous waste, go in there, then boom, it's going to tell you, you know, you're going to see where you're going and what you want to look for. Trying to make it very, very user-friendly, but the hazardous waste basically is for residential and businesses that generate less than 200 pounds a month, which are called SQGs, small quantity generator. They come in on Thursdays, and they have to pay for their waste because they don't pay into the program how we collect. We collect off your utility bill, and I'm pretty sure most citizens know that. If you purchase something and it says hazardous, dangerous, toxic, you buy it retail, if you don't use the product, please don't throw it in the landfill. Go ahead and box it up and bring it to us at the hazardous waste. We segregate it, we categorize it, we lab pack it up, and we ship it south to be disposed of or incinerated properly.
Yeah, and I will attest to user friendliness and accessibility there. The volunteers, I think, that work
no,
there.
No, it's a contract. It's a contracted CBJ. It's a contracted CBJ operation.
We're great.
I oversee it, and I'm over there all the time. That's a contracted operation.
Very friendly.
Yes.
I mean, batteries, car oil,
yes.
You name it.
New one we're working on right now, I'm working on a new RFP. They've added their 3 years, and we're going out to bid on that.
RFP,
request for proposal to operate it. I'm hoping that I get three or four proposals in, and I'm going to review the proposals. We're expanding and asking for things that they might not want to do, but we're asking them for it. One of them is boating flares, a whole nother subject. They might come in and say it's 10 bucks a pound and we can't afford it, but we're asking for it. Another thing that we are working on through that RFP is the issue with the CBJ needle program. You know, you have, I think her name's, well, I'm not familiar with her. I've never met her that runs the against heroin users and the needle. But we are now trying to set up a program where we can run the infectious needles, and that's what it is, needles that's, you know, diabetic, any of that, and run it through the facility and get it shipped south through the contractor and get it disposed of properly.
All right. Jim Pinor, Solid Waste Coordinator / CBJ Recycle Works Director.
Yeah, I'm not a director. I'm the Solid Waste Coordinator, and it might be Recycle Works something or other here coming up, but we got the hazardous waste program, the recycling program. Things are picking up. We hopefully are going to expand our cardboard substantially, and I'm excited about the program.
What's the easiest way to find you on the web?
New website. New website coming up. JunoRecycling.com. Thank you for bringing that up, because there's so much to talk about. I could talk for an hour. But new website, JunoRecycling, all one word, JunoRecycling.com, will take you right to CBJ's. We linked it in to the CBJ's website, and it will take you right to Recycle Works.
Jim, thanks for coming on the show today.
Thanks. Thank you for having me.
All right. See ya.
Okay.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 15th of August, 2016. Birthday of the Swedish novelist Stieg Larsson, born in Skelleftehamn, Sweden, 1954, took up fiction writing as a way to make some extra money. Started in 2001, He had written two novels, started on a third when he approached an editor. He was planning 10 detective thrillers called the Millennium Series, but he died of a heart attack the following year. His three novels published posthumously. The first, in Swedish, is called Men Who Hate Women, better known as The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. It's the birthday of a poet who took up writing novels for money, Sir Walter Scott, born Edinburgh, 1771. He wrote narrative romances in verse, but he was a partner in a printing firm that almost went bankrupt. He paid the firm's debts, almost went under himself, and so he published his novel Waverley in 1814. It was a big success. Followed it with Rob Roy, The Bride of Lammermoor, and Ivanhoe. It's the birthday of Edna Ferber, born 1885, Kalamazoo, Michigan, started out as a journalist in Appleton, Wisconsin, later moved to New York, became part of the Algonquin Round Table, best known for her novel of 1924, So Big, also Showboat, which was made into a musical by Jerome Kern, Oscar Hammerstein II. Her obituary on the front page of the New York Times said her books were not profound, but they were vivid. Here's a poem for today by W.S. Merwin, Mr. Daly. Mr. Daly could whistle between his teeth, but just the one phrase over and over, it was in the good old summer time, and it made my mother sniff and shake her head as he pushed the big wooden spoon around and around the pot of flour paste he was mixing on the old coal range in the back kitchen near the laundry tubs that smelled of laundry tubs, as the flour paste smelled of flour paste, and Mr. Daly smelled of Mr. Daly in a stale shirt. He was old, in his 50s, with a hump between his shoulders, and it was still summertime, and he would carry the pot up the back stairs to the heat of the attic, where he had already carried the truckload of mattress cartons, one at a time, got for nothing from the furniture store and funeral parlor on South Main Street, and he had nailed them up under the attic beams, and then would paper them end to end with old church bulletins as insulation, because the house was so cold in winter. He kept laughing to himself about something while he worked and whistled. They said he was not like his daughter Isabel, whom they admired, who worked in Thomas's piano store that would burn down one winter with icicles forming from the jets of the fire hoses and the flames racing up inside the rooms until the top floors stacked high with pianos crashed slowly together through icicles and piano chords chiming in chorus while I stood watching from across the street on the stone steps of the Methodist Church, remembering Mr. Daly whistling between his teeth in the good old summertime. A poem by W.S. Merwin, Mr. Daly, from The Moon Before Morning, published by Copper Canyon Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity. Brain training with over 50 challenging games, from scientists working with university researchers to push cognitive research forward. Learn more at lumosity.com. And by Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, home, boat, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles, at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon, and here on Monday, August 15th, 2016, Scott Burton, your host, in the studio with me now are Donnie Gott and also Eric Kiefner. Eric, you are an appreciator of things Shakespeare. Donnie, you're an actor, professional actor, among other things. Can I get you to welcome to the show, you two?
Thank you.
What? How did I mess up, Eric? What? How should I title you?
I'm just helping out in these readings that we're doing here. I am an English major in college, and I have read all these plays at some point, and I wanted to read because I had the time to do it. So.
Okay.
I'm a volunteer, but I've never acted in Theater in the Rough, and I wouldn't presume to be on the same stage with Donnie, except she's permitted me to read with her.
Okay. What is the first folio?
The first folio is Visiting Juno. This is an edition of Shakespeare's plays that was put together by a couple of his friends and fellow actors. Shortly after his death, they got together and said, you know, these are great plays, let's print them up. And they printed them in a very distinguished format. It was like doing a hardbound, leather-bound copy of a book nowadays, because it was not a paperback, it was not a pamphlet, it was formally bound in very large pieces of paper. That's what a folio is. And sold to people in England who had appreciated his plays. There are maybe 600 copies of the first folio in the world, and about 200 of them exist at the Folger Library in Washington, D.C. I may have my numbers wrong, but there's something like that. It's in the hundreds. And this particular edition is very beautiful. You should go look at it. It's at the State Library, the Andrew P. Kashavarov Library. And it's open every day from noon to 6, I believe, for the next week. So hurry up and get there. And so that's the whole occasion for this reading of the first folio. So that's what the first folio is. It's a book.
All right. Tell us, Donnie, a little bit about readings, histories, performances that are all sort of in celebration of its being here.
Sure. Well, I'll speak to what Theater in the Rough is sort of in charge of, and that is we endeavor, and so far have persevered, in reading aloud all of Shakespeare's 36 plays. I think
all the plays that are in the first folio.
Right, that are in the first folio. Excuse me, I have to, yes, I should. There are different versions of Shakespeare, of collections of Shakespeare's work. I'm most familiar with, I guess, The Riverside would be my most familiar. And there are things that exist in that collection that are not in the folio. There are things in the folio that are not in The Riverside. There are people, lines have been given to other characters and entire scenes cut out. And so it's, I don't know how they decided that this was going to be their folio. They were gathering sides from other actors. I guess that was probably difficult to get actors to get together all of their papers. But anyway, so what we have are the 36 that are in the folio. That's what we are attempting to read. We started on the 25th of July with Much Ado About Nothing, and we've moved through Monday through Friday in the evenings, 7 to 10 p.m., and then Saturdays all day from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. We read 4 a day on Saturdays at McFeeters, and what we've done is we've had different venues throughout town every day of the week. Has a same venue each week. So Mondays we're at the Jack, Tuesdays we're at the Egan Library, Wednesdays we have been at Rockwell, although we're moving this week to McFeeters this Wednesday night, simply because we need to be able to hear a little bit better. Thursdays we're at the Valley Library, Friday we're at the APK building, and then Saturdays again at McFeeters Hall. And we are, I think, 25 in?
Well, I'm looking now at the schedule, and it looks like we have 9 left.
We have 9 left.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6,
so we're starting tonight with As You Like It at the Jack. It's a comedy. It's a funny one. and so far they've all been really well attended. So
As You Like It tonight at the Jack, what time?
Yes, 7 p.m.
So you have this great calendar in front of you. I imagine that's posted around town. Is it online somewhere,
yes,
too?
Yes, this is at the TR website, theaterintherough.org. And then I think that it may also be tied to the Alaska State Museum's website. If you go there and just click on the icon of First Folio, it's that sort of a burgundy and teal icon of Shakespeare's face. Just click on that, and you'll bring yourself to a page that tells you all sorts of different events that are happening in conjunction with our readings. There are also events that are hosted by the Juneau Public Library. There are events that are hosted by the Alaska State Museum. I have some of those in front of me right now. if you'd like me to read them off to you.
Sure.
Because there's a lot more going on than just these readings, although these readings have been what we have been working on the most. As you can imagine, it's taken a lot of time and energy. They're fully cast. Each play's fully cast. So you come to hear a reading, and the director or whoever was in charge with wrangling has tried to cast it in such a way that the reading will be entertaining and the people will enjoy Shakespeare instead of
some of the readings are more some of the readings are more like plays than others, with props and moving around a little bit. Some of them are harder to do. Battle scenes are tough, so we haven't done that much.
We have been banging foils together.
Right. And thunder. We had thunder and drums.
Yes.
Donnie is really good on drums.
So this is a lot of work you all have put in. This is a lot of time. What is it about Shakespeare's work that has made you so passionate about it? Maybe it's obvious, but I'd love
no,
to hear it from you guys.
I don't think that it is obvious, or I wouldn't be trying so hard all the time to tell everyone how awesome Shakespeare is. And getting friends to come who say, that's just not my thing. I don't really want to. But it's just... Yeah, but I think that he writes about issues and relationships and what it is to be a human being in the world. When you read about these characters and you read their inner thoughts, they correspond to right now. It's very human, and there's a lot of humanity in there, and I think it's a way to understand each other more. To read through these stories and to learn from these characters and to try and be as human as you can be. And Shakespeare, I mean, he has some really horrible people, and he says some horrible things, and we've had to really think about some of the language that he uses is really politically incorrect, frankly. And so it's hard that if you're going to... Do you read this first folio, this Shakespeare, do you read it exactly as he wrote it? Because you don't want to turn anyone off, but... But all those things exist in this world, and it's art, and so I guess he can hide behind that. But I just think that there's a lot of humanity in his stories, and the writing is just gorgeous once you unpack it and sort of realize, and not be scared of it, and just embrace it as it's English language. It's just it's a little bit heightened.
Great answer. Eric, would you add something to that?
Hard to add. I guess one thing you have to realize is that it has lasted 400 years. Some people I tried to get to read and said, oh, I can't read that. It's old English. Well, that made me cringe because, of course, it's not at all old English. Old English is from the year 800 to 1100, and we're talking about writing in 1590. So this is not old English, middle English. This is... And I wouldn't call it modern English. It's Shakespearean English. And that is one reason why I find it great to read these, because Shakespeare really did invent language. And there's a lot of words, as Katie Jensen has pointed out a couple times, that don't appear anywhere until they appear in Shakespeare. And then they start getting used. And so there are not only the famous phrases that you've heard before, from the plays, to be or not to be.
Star-crossed lovers, right. Band of brothers.
Out, brief candle.
Every dog has his day.
Right. But there's also words that don't appear anywhere else until they appear in Shakespeare, and then they are used. So he was a great creator of words. He was a great creator of drama. I can't say he was a great creator of plots. A lot of his plots are stolen from other places, except for one we did last week, Midsummer Night's Dream, which is notably doesn't have any sources that are known to anyone else. It seems to be purely the plot product of his imagination. And it's particularly light and delightful, partly, I guess, because of that. He was completely unconstrained in making it up.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just wonderful to listen to and a lot of fun and very funny sometimes and serious sometimes. And he just had a great intelligence that's very well expressed in words.
I wish we had more time, you two. But I bet people could come and see you tonight or some of your fellow actors.
Please come, if you can, tonight to the Jack at 7, As You Like It.
What is As You Like It, Donnie?
As You Like It is a comedy where girls dress up as boys and boys try to woo them. It's very, very funny. It contains the famous All the World a Stage speech. And it is a lovely, lovely play read by a handful of very lovely people. Tomorrow night, the 16th at 7 p.m. at the Egan Library, Mary Wise of Windsor. McPheeters Hall, 7 p.m., Titus Andronicus on Wednesday night. The Valley Library on Thursday, The Merchant of Venice, a trouble play, but a good play. And Friday night at APK, Romeo and Juliet.
With a balcony.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then Saturday, four plays, Timid of Athens, Winter's Tale, Comedy of Errors, The Tempest, starting at 10 a.m. at McPheeters Hall.
Remind us the website again?
Theaterintherough.org.
Okay. Thank you so much, you two, Eric Kiefner and Donnie Gott, for all your work on this. It's great talking to you two as well.
Thanks.
This is Bird Note. When it comes to making and using tools, we humans are the experts. Chimpanzees sometimes employ simple tools too, like sticks for probing for food. But it appears that chimpanzees may share second place with the New Caledonian crow. These birds are known for using twig-like implements to feed themselves. Their utensils include special probes the birds clip from plant leaves with their beaks. A few years ago, scientists were astonished to see what a crow they'd named Betty could do with simple pieces of wire. Taking a straight piece of wire, Betty quickly bent one end into a hook and then used the hooked end to haul up a tiny bucket of meat from the bottom of a long tube. And it was no accident. Tested again, the clever crow repeatedly bent wires into hooks using varied techniques. But now, there's more. According to phys.org.com, New Zealand scientists studying New Caledonian crows have found they can use three different tools in succession to gain a food treat. Almost stranger still, one bird spent nearly 2 full minutes simply studying the problem and then completed the task the first time without error. Don't believe it? Check out the videos at birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
Programming is made possible in part by Juno's Own Alaska Pure Mountain Spring Water, available in Juno stores or delivered in 5-gallon jugs to homes and offices. 780-4262.
Hi, I'm Sister Grace. I'm the host of Friday Tidelines on KRNN. I listen to KRNN for the wide variety of music, the entertaining DJs, and the connection to the community. Tune in to KRNN 102.7.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, August 15th. It's about 8 minutes until the top of the hour. And joining me on the phone now is documentary maker Catherine Axley. Welcome to the show, Catherine.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Yeah. So you are working on a film about legendary dog musher George Atla. You want to tell us a little bit about your project?
Yeah, so I was very lucky to be able to film with George last year as he trained his grandnephew, Joe Byfelt, to race in the Open North American race last year. Originally, he was training for the Ferrandi, but it was canceled due to the lack of snow. But and George, of course, tragically passed away while we were filming. So I made a short 20-minute film about their relationship, about this mentorship leading up to the race. But now I'm gearing up to make a feature-long version for public television that both tells that story that we filmed last year, as well as George's life story. So we're on a massive hunt for as much archival photos and footage as possible to be able to tell his story in a really beautiful way with real materials.
George is a big deal in the dog mushing world, right?
Yes. Yeah. He has the most championships for a sprint racer, and amazingly sustained a career for over 40 years. His first race was in 1958 at the Ferrandi, and his last Ferrandi, I believe, was 94. But he continued to race in village races up until his late 70s. So he had quite the long racing career.
And where are you based out of, and what inspired you to pursue and learn more about George?
So I'm based in California. I was a grad student at Stanford, and my good friend is Jonathan Christ Tompkins, the state representative out of Sitka. So I traveled to see him a couple summers ago because I was really interested in the efforts behind HB 260, the bill to recognize Native languages as official languages of the state. And you know how one thing leads to another. One person knows someone who knows someone, and then I heard about George's story, and I couldn't believe, first of all, I thought his story was remarkable. I thought it was incredible that at such in his early 80s, he was rededicating his life to bring village to bring dog mushing back to villages, and I thought that was a fascinating part of who he was and what his career meant. So I approached him, and I was lucky to be able to build a relationship where we were able to start filming. And so I'm still down in California, but actually right now I'm on the road to the airport because we're heading up to Anchorage tonight to continue filming more interviews for the film, both in Anchorage and in Fairbanks.
Okay. And like you said, you're looking for photographs, probably newspaper articles, any kind of video footage, anything related to George.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yes. And even taped races, if someone taped a race that was playing on TV, even that is wonderful because you know, in the 80s, you know, with videotape, a lot of races that were on TV were not taped. So we're looking for anything that people have, either home movies or taped footage, but also, like you said, photos or newspaper clippings.
All right. And if somebody has that, any footage related to George Atla, how can they get that to you?
Yeah, so we have a website, atlafilm.com, so atlafilm.com, and then we have an email address, atlafilm@gmail.com. So if people are able to access that way, otherwise I can also provide a phone number. But we also have a Facebook page where we post updates. So if people are interested in the film but might not have materials but just want to stay updated on the progress, they can visit facebook.com/atladocumentary.
Okay. Listeners, if you have anything related to George Atla, please get a hold of Catherine Axley here. You can find her at atlafilm.com, atlafilm@gmail.com, or you can find the Atla Film Project on Facebook. Catherine, I wish we had more time. I wish you luck. Sounds like a great film. Quickly, is there anything else you'd like to add?
I think that's it, but just to let everyone know, the film will probably be finished in a little over a year and will be airing on public television because we have support, so probably sometime in 2018. So we're very excited about that.
Well, good luck, and we're looking forward to it.
Great. Thanks so much, Scott.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon. Looks like the weather forecast for tonight calls for showers with lows around 51, precipitation at 100%. Tomorrow, the forecast calls for partly sunny with highs near 62. Tuesday is showers likely, mainly before 4 p.m., cloudy with a high near 60. Thanks again for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon.